Hello, Saints. Well, last time we looked at the blessing of Jacob under Laban. So this time we're going to continue on with our studies in the life of the saint in chapter 31. And today's message is really all about the return, God calling Jacob back to the land of his family and back to the land where he was to receive his inheritance. So in chapter 31 of Genesis, we'll start in verse 13, and it says, "I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family." We see here straight away that the calling is God's. It's in God's time. The time of testing had been over for Jacob. He'd been 20 years in the house of Laban, and it had been one of trial and testing, one of conflict. But God is now the one that is ordering his steps, and he's saying, it's time for you to return. It's time for you to come back. Not only was this a time of testing and trial for God's saint, but also it was one of prosperity. He'd been there 20 years, 14 years he worked for free for two wives. And in the remaining 6 years, we learnt last time that it was a time of prosperity for Jacob, a time where God actually blessed him and removed the wealth of Laban and put it into Jacob's pockets. But there's dangers in prosperity. And it was God's time. He didn't leave him there so that he could build and build and build upon his wealth. He had already become wealthy enough. And in God's own way, I think he realized that it was time to move Jacob on. Maybe Jacob had become too comfy with all the wealth that he had acquired. And the call is that he is to depart from this land. He is to return. He is to return to God's promises and the calling. And God is saying, I want you to separate yourself from Laban. I want you to separate yourself from the world that you find yourself in. And I want you to come back into the land of Canaan. And there's times in our lives, prosperity is great. But has there been times in our own lives where God has actually called us away? Because these things potentially can be very distracting. You can become too comfortable when you're wealthy. You can become too consumed with the things of the world. And God often has to draw us away from those things again and back unto himself. So potentially, this may be behind what is Jacob has had 6 years of incredible wealth, and God is now saying, now's the time. I want you to get out of this land and return to your family. So in verse 14, then Jacob and Leah answered and said to him, "Is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it." So you see here straight away that there's lots of family issues going on. Rachel and Leah, the question is there any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? That's a weird thing to say about your father, but it shows that there was a lot of disconnect between Laban's method of life and the way that he treated his kids and the relationship between the two. For he has sold us, they said, and he has also completely consumed our money. So in other words, everything that they look toward their father to have for them as an inheritance, they say it's completely gone. For all these riches which God has taken from your father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said, you do it. So in other words, they're being obedient unto their husband, and they're saying, whatever God is leading you to do, we're with you in this. So then verse 17, so Jacob arose and he set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock, which he had gained in Padan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. We'll come back to that later on. And Jacob stole away unknown to Laban the Syrian, and that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and he crossed the river and headed toward the mountains of Gilead. So after 20 years of being under this man Laban, as soon as he got the direction from God that he wanted him to return, he waited for an opportunity because Laban had gone to shear the sheep, and he seized the opportunity and he took off. I'm not completely convinced about Jacob's motives here, because he's taken the opportunity when Laban is there instead of being up front with Laban about returning home. He obviously didn't trust him. And he seized the opportunity when Laban was away, and he gathered all his family and off he goes. So Jacob's motives in this are probably they're probably dominated by distrust of Laban and probably fear. He just didn't trust what Laban would actually do, whether he would actually let him go or not. So he's doing the right thing by being obedient to God, but possibly not in regard to the whole family scenario with Laban, whom he's been under. He's doing it secretively, and he's seizing the opportunity. So all of those motives are probably the old Jacob. And sometimes we also do the same things when we're afraid of things or we distrust people. We'll do things like that. So try to get away with that without having to confront them or the issue. So verse 22 to 29, so Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. So he'd gone quite a few days away to shear sheep. 3 days later he found out about it. And then he took his brethren with him, and he pursued him for 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. But God had come to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night, and said to him, "Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad." So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword? Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? For I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with timbrel and harp." Well, I actually doubt that, but this is Laban's defense anyway. "And you did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you have done so foolishly in so doing. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.'" So we see in this passage that after hearing, 3 days after Jacob had taken off, that he pursued him. And Laban pursued Jacob to actually do him harm. We see this from in verse 29. He says, "It is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night." That was in the heart of Laban. And God actually had to intervene. He had to intervene, and he had to come to him with a dream at night. And he said to him, "I'm watching. You be careful what you say and what you do to my servant Jacob. I'm listening." So God was the one that actually intervened here, because Laban had intentions of actually harming him. He gathered his men and they took after him. Took them 7 days to get him. And God intervened because he knew what was in the heart of Laban, that he was going to get Jacob. But God said, "I'm watching. I'm watching what you say, and you better treat my servant properly." And Laban actually took heed to this dream. He knew that it had come from God. So you got this little picture here. Remember, the whole scene of this chapter is about returning to to God's calling, or returning to the land of Canaan. Yes, God had been with Jacob in this 20-year period of testing, but he's calling him to return. And you get a little picture here of someone that's wanting to come back to God, and there's always hostility when that happens, whether it be someone that has been backslidden and they're coming back, or whether it's a conversion and coming unto God. There's always hostility, and sometimes threats of violence, sometimes threats of hurt. Sometimes within family scenarios, if someone comes to the Lord, there is opposition. There are threats. We had a woman in our church that came out from India one time, and she was brought up in a Hindu culture, and Christianity was frowned upon. And when she came to the Lord, there was much opposition, and she shared her testimony with us, and what she had to go through was incredible. She was locked in a room. She was starved, all in the hope that she would give up her Christian faith. She was beaten. This is by her family members. And this went on for long, long periods of time. And in the end, she had to escape. She had to escape from her own family, and she was hidden by Christians in India. And in the end, because she came from quite a wealthy Christian family, they wouldn't accept what had happened to her, her conversion, and they had people hunting for her, and they paid people to try and find her, and she had to find her way out of India to New Zealand, and never to see her family again. That was it. So this little picture here of returning to the land is commonplace. There is always threats. There is always opposition. There is always people that potentially want to do you harm. And Laban had these intentions for Jacob. He didn't want him to return. But God intervened and said, "Look, you watch what you say. He's my servant." So God spoke to him in a dream. And in verse 30, "And now you are surely gone, because you greatly long for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" So then you've got this scenario. In verse 19, it says that Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. And Laban hears about this, and part of his pursuit was also to return, wanting the return of the family gods. So it shows that he was multi-faithed. He heard from God in a dream, but he also had the household idols. But it raises the question, why did Rachel take the household idols? Why did she take them? Did they have some type of wealth that she wanted to acquire or take from her father? Did they have something that were of significance? Were they a part of the pantheon of gods that they all followed? Like, she was brought up under Laban's household, so obviously he had these household idols. He was an idolater. He worshipped these things, but more than that, they were a big part of his wealth and the family dynamics. Mesopotamian history declares that whoever had possession of household idols in that time had some rights as an heir. So if you owned these idols, you had rights as an heir to all that Laban had. So potentially they did have great wealth, and maybe Rachel took them because she wanted to get something from her father. She said back in verse 15, "We're considered strangers by him. He sold us and he's completely consumed all our money." In other words, everything that he had been taken from him. Maybe she was after just something that she could get out of the household. But she takes these idols. And we don't know why she actually took them. Potentially, they might have actually meant something to her. Yes, she was married to Jacob, who followed the one true God, but was this woman someone that followed a multiple gods? We're unsure. So Laban, he comes to him and he says to Jacob, "Why did you steal my gods?" Now Jacob is completely unaware. He doesn't know anything of what's going on. So verse 31, Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force." Now Jacob is completely honest here. He's 100% honest. This is why he crept away while Laban was away. He was afraid. And he's straight up with Laban. He says, "I was afraid." Fear dominated his decision to sneak away. "Perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force." So he didn't trust Laban one little bit. He'd been with this man 20 years and he didn't trust him. He thought that he would not allow his daughters to go back home. So Jacob decided in his own wisdom, "I'm going to sneak away." And then in verse 32, "With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live." Now Jacob is completely unaware that his beloved bombshell of the desert, Rachel, has stolen these gods. He doesn't know, but here he is saying, if you find whoever's stolen them, you can kill her. Big call. Jacob didn't know that that Rachel had stolen them. So he says, "Do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you." For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So now Laban starts the hunt. Someone has nicked his idols, and he's sure that he knows who it is. And it's interesting the order that he goes. Now Laban went into Jacob's tent. Why do you think he went into Jacob's tent first? It was because there was so much distrust between these two. He was sure that Jacob had actually stolen his idols. So he goes into his tent first. But he couldn't find anything. And then he goes into Leah's tent. And into her two maids' tents. But he did not find them there. And then he went out of Leah's tent and he entered Rachel's tent. There's a progression here of who he thinks. He thinks Jacob has stolen. Okay, if it's not Jacob, it must be Leah or her maids. But if it's not Leah, it must be Rachel. The one that he least expected, Rachel, was the tent that he checked last. He least expected her. He expected it to be in the other two, potentially. And this is sometimes quite consistent. The one that you least expect could be the rottenest one in the bunch. We had a little incident here that we used to, with our kids, they're always devouring the chocolate. So we used to have to try and hide the chocolate so that it wouldn't go in a day type thing. And we noticed that our chocolate was going down and down and down. And I was sure that it was my boy. And I confronted him about it. And he said, no. But the chocolate was still disappearing. Someone had found their way to it. And I was sure it was him. And he said, no, it wasn't him. Little did we find out a little bit later. We never really got to the bottom of it. But it was actually the one that I least expected. It was my daughter. And what she was doing was, after we had all gone to bed at night, she was getting up, sneaking out. She'd found where we were, and she was there eating the chocolate at night while we were in bed asleep. But I least expected her. She was the one I least expected. And it's probably like this here with Laban. He expected it to be Jacob. He expected it to be Leah, and he checks Rachel's tent last. So, and he didn't find it. Now, in verse 34, it says, "Now Rachel had taken the household idols, and she put them in the camel saddle and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them." She's come up with this cunning plan. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of woman is with me, and he searched, but he did not find the household idols. The plan that Rachel came up with was her menstrual cycle, and it was enough to deceive her father. It's actually a cunning plan, and he trusted her. He didn't ask her to get up and to check what she was sitting on. She just assumed that because of the menstrual cycle, he wouldn't require of her to actually rise. Now, the picture is actually quite a good one, and to the Jewish mind, they would understand this picture. In Leviticus 15, verse 19 and 20, it says this: if a woman has a discharge, and the discharge from her body is blood, she shall be set apart 7 days, and whoever touches her shall be unclean until evening. So in other words, when the woman had her menstrual cycle, she was unclean. And in verse 20, everything that she lies on during her impurity shall be unclean, and also everything that she sits on shall be unclean. So the picture you've got here, to the Jewish mind, is what she is unclean, and what she is sitting on is unclean. So the picture is actually quite true, because in her menstrual cycle she is unclean, and the very idols that she's sitting on are definitely unclean. They're an abomination unto God. So here she is, sitting on them, she's unclean, and the idols are unclean. But she deceives her father. Laban cannot find the idols, and her plan is a cunning one. When you read the whole story of all of these people involved in this family, they were very deceitful, very cunning, and they're no different to the rest of us, that's for sure. So, Rachel and her idols, we're not sure why she took them, but she did. It's unclear. But also, there can be a picture here of Rachel being a picture of a believer returning to the land of Canaan, yet she's still got idols. She's returning to God's calling and God's blessing in the land of Canaan, but yet she's got that in one hand, and she's got these idols that she won't give up in the other hand. Now, to her, these idols potentially might have been wealth and security, because they had, in that culture, they had something to do with heirs to the property and rights to the property. So there's many, like when we think about idols in our own life, many people come to the Lord, but they're still hanging on to other things. Now remember, an idol is really anything that puts its place instead of the preeminence of Christ, instead of having the Lord reigning over your life. Sometimes we can have idols, and these can be wealth. Wealth and security can be a huge idol to the believers, that we trust more in money, we trust more in security, we trust more in position, and job securities, in the home that we may have, in relationships. Idols can be all sorts of things. They can be our love of sports, they can be our love of recreation, they can be pets, they could be alcohol addictions, they could be sex, they could be social media. All of these things that take the place that God should actually take in our life. So idols are really anything that places itself above God and his calling for us, and Christ and his preeminence, that he really should have first place. In 1 John 5:21, there's just this beautiful little verse that says, "Little children," one sentence, "keep yourself from idols." In other words, don't allow idolatry to have a place. And in Colossians, it says we are to put away idolatry and covetousness and things like that. So Rachel here is a picture. Yes, she's returning with Jacob to the land of blessing, But she's got that in one hand and she's got idols in another. And so for me, she pictures many believers, many people that are on their journey back to God or returning to God, returning to the land, but yet they're believers in one hand, but in the other, they need these other things to make them feel secure, whether they're of wealth or whether she actually did believe in a pantheon of gods. It's unclear, but she took them. So then Jacob's response, we'll just read it from 36 through to 43, and he's really frustrated and really angry. Then Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban, and Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me?" He's still ignorant of what Rachel had done. "Although you have searched all my things, what part of your household have you found? Set it here before my brethren and you and your brethren, that they may judge between us both." He wants everything out in the open. Then he gives his, "These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried the young. I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you, and I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was, in the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been in your house 20 years, and I served you 14 years for your two daughters, and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. Now there's only a few recorded wages of changing, so obviously a lot more went on than what is recorded for Jacob to have said that over that period of time his wages would be changed 10 times. "Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed." In other words, Jacob is giving it to Laban. He's telling him, "I've been completely honorable in the way that I've worked toward you. I've done my very best. Everything, even if there was a loss of beast or anything, you required it, I had to pay for it. Whether it was stolen, I had to pay for it. I worked incredibly hard, and you have deceived me and deceived me. You've changed my wages 10 times, but God was with me. And God was with me. You would have sent me away with absolutely nothing," he said to Laban, "because you're a wretch and you're a deceitful man. But God was with me, and he has sent me away with my hands full." And it was God's doing. It wasn't Jacob's. "God has seen the affliction and the labor of my hands, and he's rebuked you last night," which actually did happen. "And Laban answered and said to Jacob, 'These daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children. And this flock is my flock. All that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne?'" In other words, he did have all that, but God had removed it all from him. Verse 34. "Now, therefore, come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and I." So there's now to be a covenant set up between these two men. There was no trust between the two of them. And what they had come to is that they didn't trust each other one little bit. So therefore, they need to make this agreement and this covenant. And God was the one that was going to be the witness. God was the one that was going to have to watch between the two of these, because they distrusted each other so much. After 20 years, they had to come to an agreement that God, and a covenant had to be set up, and God would have to be the one that would watch over them. So Jacob took a stone in verse 45 and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his brethren, "Gather stones," and they took stones, and they made a heap, and they ate there on the heap. And Laban called it Jagir Sahaduth, and Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore its name was called Galeed. Also Mizpah, which means watchtower, or to watch. May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. So this is what this covenant is all about. That God was the one that was going to be watching. Laban didn't trust Jacob, and Jacob didn't trust Laban. So Laban is saying, I want this to be set up, and God is going to be watching you. Verse 50, if you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives beside my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is a witness between you and me. Then Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap, and here is this pillar, which I have placed between you and me. Now this heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness, that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. So in other words, Laban is saying, God is going to have to be this witness how you are actually going to treat my children. But also, that this is going to be a boundary set up, that I'm not going to come over this boundary, and you're not going to come over this boundary, that we will not harm one another. These guys just don't trust each other one little bit. And also remember that Laban is missing the household idols, which in the culture of that day, the person who had them was an heir and had rights to the wealth of Laban. So potentially behind all this, he's saying, you stay over there, I'll stay over here, and let it be like that. He didn't want someone coming back claiming any rights. So when you get to verse 53, you really start to see the difference between these two. As they swear, you see the difference. Now God, and this is still Laban speaking, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father, judge between us. So Laban was multi-faithed. He had many gods. We know that because he had household idols. And when he swears upon this covenant, this is really brought out. He swears by the God of Abraham, which was the true God. Abraham served the one and true God, but Abraham lived in a land that was full of idolatry. And Abraham was called out of an idolatrous land. There is no record of Abraham's father or his father before him have been serving the one true God, but he was called out from his family to come unto the land of Canaan. So he swears by the God of Abraham, but he also swears by the God of Nahor, and he swears by the God of Nahor's father. Now they were all idolatrous. And you see here that in Laban's life, he was also multi-faithed. He could be one minute hearing from God, being warned in a dream and acknowledging that. But on the other hand, he had household idols and he wanted the return of them. He swears by one God and he swears by another God. He's multi-faithed. Now this is very similar to Zephaniah and the days of Israel. Turn to Zephaniah, which is... Zephaniah, where are we? After Habakkuk. So Zephaniah chapter 1, you get the same scenario with the nation of Judah. And the theme to the book of Zephaniah is the day of the Lord. So it speaks of what was happening in Zephaniah's day, which he was under Josiah, was the king at that day, and it pictures what is happening in the last days of the house of Judah before they were taken into captivity, but it also speaks about what things will be like at the end, because the theme is the day of the Lord, which is that last period of the great tribulation. So in verse 4, he says of chapter 1, I'll stretch out my hand against Judah and against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I'll cut off every trace of Baal from this place, the names of the idolatrous priests with the pagan priests, those who worship the host of heaven on the housetops, and those who worship and swear oaths by the Lord, but also who swear by Milcom. From those who have turned back from following the Lord and have not sought the Lord nor inquired of him. So the picture you get here is of a backslidden Judah. This is the time of what it was like just before they were taken into captivity. And their leaders and their religious priests are all involved in this. But the state of the nation was incredibly corrupt, incredibly multi-faith, and it pictures what it will be like at the end. You see here that they had Baal worship, the names of the idolatrous priests and pagan priests, but see here that they worshipped the host of heaven on the housetops, and they also worshipped and swear oaths by the Lord. You had a multi-faith. They could worship to deities on their housetops, but then they could say oaths and make pledges to the Lord religiously, but they had all of these things going on. And they also swear by Milcom. Milcom was the Amorite god by whom they used to sacrifice children to. Milcom is probably one of the worst false deities of that time that required child sacrifice, and God is judging the nation of Israel because of their multi-faith and because of these idolatrous gods that were amongst them. Milcom, he required child sacrifice. Do we think that the West is going to get away with abortion? It won't. There'll be a judgment come upon the West at some point for the amount of children and babies that the West has legally killed. Legally killed. Judgment will come at some point, just as it did for the nation of Israel here, but also it pictures what it will be like at the end. And the church in the last days also will be like Laban, multi-faithed. As it was in Zephaniah's day with the nation of Judah, they were multi-faith and judgment had to come. It'll be like that in the last days. There will be some that will swear oaths by the Lord, but they'll also worship other things. It'll be like this. So Laban was like this. Laban had these gods, but he also heard from the one true God. He was multi-faithed. Judah was like it before its captivity, so also will be the church. There'll be a mix of everything, many gods. All paths lead to God, they believe. And judgment came upon them for child sacrifice, the West at some point will have to be judged according to abortion, that legal killing of the unborn. Is one of the highest deaths in our country, and I'm sure in many Western countries it's the same. So back to Laban in Genesis 31. So Laban swears by the God of Abraham, by the God of Abraham's father Nahor, and by his father before. In other words, multi. There's no record of them being worshippers. Abraham was called out of Mesopotamia after coming into a relationship with God. But Jacob, on the other hand, in verse 53, he swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Nothing else. Just one thing. Isaac was no idolater, so there's no compromise with Jacob. There's only one true God, And he swears by the fear of his father Isaac. And he's one that uses this term, and he uses it twice. He uses it in verse 42, unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me. This is a reference to the one true God, the one God that Jacob's father had a relationship with, Isaac. He was no idolater. There was no compromise with him. There was only one true God. So Jacob doesn't, he is, you see, a good thing here, he's not multi-faith, just one. I swear by the fear of my father Isaac. And Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain, and he called his brethren to eat bread, and they ate bread, and they stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning Laban arose, and he kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them, and then Laban departed and returned to his place. Here we are, complete separation. There was a monument set up. They were never to go back there, and Laban was never to come across again. And it is like that. When we come to the Lord, there has to be a separation at some point from the things of Laban and from the things of the world and the things of God. So Jacob is now on his journey. His motives to steal away were probably ruled by fear and distrust, but God was with him and God had called him, and this covenant is set up. They don't trust each other one little bit. God has to be the one that is watching. So now Jacob's on his journey. So when we get to chapter 32, we start to get into some good stuff. Here's another encounter with angels. And we start to see the humanity. Even though God has called us back to himself and he's called us to the land of blessing, our humanity still rules us so much. And we see this with Jacob. He sees Esau coming toward him with 400 men. And how does he react? Again, he reacts in his flesh with being afraid and fearful. And so we're going to have a look at that next time in chapter 32, because he is so similar to us. How do we react with situations that we're afraid of? And he's been 20 years away from his brother, and he's got to go and face him at some point. So we'll have a look at that in the near future. So God bless. I pray that you've seen something, or more than me, in this chapter 31. And it's one of returning and one of separation. Amen.